This is Digital Story Podcast number 665, December 11th, 2018. Today's theme is Inside Capture One Pro 12 with David Grover. I'm Derek Story. Phase One has just released Capture One Pro 12, its robust image management and editing software. Capture One has been gaining traction over the last few releases because many consider it a high-quality alternative to Lightroom, myself included. Today we have David Grover on the horn. He's Phase One's business support and development manager, and he's one of their best trainers as well. I hope you enjoy his insights on this latest release of Capture One Pro. So David and I sat down a couple days ago, fortunately before my cold, so you get to hear my real voice, not this voice. And he has lots of terrific things to say. We went through really what I consider all the highlights in this new release, Capture One Pro 12. And I think this is a terrific piece of software. It's been evolving over the years, and they've done a great job of refining it each step of the way. So let's listen to what David has to say, and then I'll come back on afterward. I'm here with David Grover, and David, you are with Phase One, and you've been my contact for Capture One Pro for some time. How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks, Derek. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm really looking forward to talking to you about version 12 here. This is a pretty substantial update.
We certainly think so. Updates are always a long time in the making, and it's a constant process, and we always want to do more, of course. We're really happy with how Capture One 12's turned out.
So before we jump into the new features, and there are some on this list I'm just dying to ask you about, just tell us, everyone here listening, a little bit about what you do there and how long you've been doing it.
So I joined Phase One in 2012. So that's, nigh on 6.5 years now. Blimey. So that's gone quick. So when I joined, we were on the cusp of Capture One 7, I think. So what I do there is essentially create a lot of educational material for Capture One. So we have sort of short tutorials and snippets and blog posts and so on. And I'm often the face that you see at sort of trade shows and events and those kinds of things. And I also work a fair bit with our partners like Fujifilm and Sony and so on.
And don't forget the legendary webinars, right?
That's nice of you to say so. I've been on a short break for webinars just because I was so busy with everything that we were doing to make Capture One 12 as good as possible. But I'm starting right up again, probably as we speak, actually. So depending when this goes out, then you'll find a webinar happening in the very near vicinity, I would think.
That's awesome. Mm. Well, let's jump into the features. And I'm sure that you guys have your favorites, but there's a couple that I just want to, I'm going to start in the middle of the list, actually.
Okay.
Some of these I'm really excited about, but we should probably start with, just the interface refresh itself. Tell me a little bit about that and what some of the thinking was there.
Yeah, sure. The interface has changed a little bit over the years. So I would say from Capture One 6, 7, it didn't change much. 8, sort of a minor change. And then really, I guess 9, 10, and 11, there wasn't a great deal sort of changes. Just little tweaks and touch-ups here and there, but nothing really as substantial as this version. So we wanted to modernize it. It was looking a little bit dated, if you like, and also make some usability changes, like make the fonts a little bit bigger so it was easier to manage on 4K monitors, which of course didn't exist, or were very less prevalent than they are today. So just a few things to improve that. And so that's the visual aspect, if you like, but also on the menu side of things. So like any application, there's this menu bar along the top. that had sort of ballooned over the past few years. Kind of like, I don't know if you have one, Derek, but I have a drawer in my office which I just kind of throw stuff in and forget about it. And then every now and then you've got no idea where anything is and you have to pull it all out and kind of rearrange it and throw some stuff away. So that's kind of what we did with the menu system, is just look at where everything was and decide, does it need to be there? Does it make sense to be there? Could it go somewhere else? Or shall we just take it out? And it's just a lot more logical now. So it'll probably annoy you for a few weeks because you'll be used to going to that place where you remembered where something was. But hopefully it makes a lot more sense now.
Yeah, that was my question, actually. And you know, usually users don't like it when you do things like that. And and so have you gotten a little bit of pushback on that at all?
Actually, no. I'm surprised to say. I was kind of nervously waiting for the onslaught of criticism. But I think just because it's so much better laid out that you might find things that you never knew were there before, of course. So just the layout is much, much more logical. So in theory, it shouldn't take you long to pick it back up.
Very nice. Very nice. I like the look, by the way. I think it looks true.
Good.
Very elegant. Very elegant look.
Yeah, it's much, much cleaner. I know it shouldn't really make any difference to the application, but you know, if you're staring at it for hours and hours, which I do, then it's nice that it's pleasant to look at as well.
Absolutely. Now the next thing that I have to talk about, and I think you're the perfect person for this, is Fujifilm support, which actually started, improved, I should say, with version 11, a dot release in there somewhere. And then now we have film simulations in there. And just tell me about it, because this was kind of a sticking point for a lot of us who like Fujifilm cameras.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we've gradually been sort of adding Fuji things before the partnership, if you like, because it is a partnership. We're working very, very closely with them. So that started with supporting the X-Trans camera models. I can't remember when we put that in. It's probably longer ago than I think, but that was something, if you like, we reverse engineered and kind of put in. One of our R&D guys is a big Fuji fan, so he was quite excited that we were able to do that, and he did the decoding all by himself of the X-Trans format.
That's kind of impressive.
Yeah, it's no mean achievement, that's for sure. I mean, it's totally different to a traditional sensor, so to have to reverse engineer it is, it's quite something. But luckily, we've got clever people in the company who do that, you know, with one hand tied behind their back. So it's we're very fortunate, put it that way. So that, I think that's where it all started. Then gradually we started adding some more Fuji things. And I think because the popularity of Fuji has grown quite a lot, I think, in the past 2 or 3 years, that it kind of made sense to just kind of go all in and get the support that everybody wanted. So, and that's where we are with Capture One 11.3, I guess, which came around Photokina when it was announced, the partnership. And then we've built on that for version 12 as well with the film simulations.
Yeah, it's terrific. And, you know, because there's always this thing like, why won't Phase One support Fujifilm medium format and, you know, and all that kind of thing. And, and, you know, on one level, it just sort of seems silly. I mean, you can kind of understand, but then you go, in the end, it's going to be better if they do support it.
And then, absolutely.
And then they came around and did it. And now, I mean, with the wonderful raw decoding that you get with Capture One Pro, and to be able to combine that with Fujifilm cameras, so much better than you get with some of the other software that we won't mention right now.
correct. Yeah.
I mean, it's a big difference. And I think raw decoding is already a strength of Capture One Pro, far and away.
Yeah.
And then to have Fujifilm cameras and now the film simulations, this is a good thing. I'm really tickled, as you can tell.
Yeah, it's really a nice bonus. And certainly digging into the problems that Fuji users have in getting good quality out of the files, I was quite surprised, and I've seen all kinds of wacky workarounds, like I convert to this first and then I go through the converter and I use a special sharpening plugin and yada yada yada, and it just, it was like, wow, this is really complicated and it shouldn't have to be like that.
Yeah, painful is the word.
Yeah, really painful. And they're great cameras and great lenses, and you know, looking at shots from older cameras like X-T2s and so on, it's I mean, not old in mm-hmm. modern day terms, if you like, but mm-hmm. really impressed with the image quality coming out of them. So and a bit kind of sad for the users that they've had to kind of jump through a lot of different hoops to sort of optimize the great hardware that it was in the first place.
Well, they don't now if they choose to.
Exactly. Yeah. I was actually visiting a Fuji office yesterday, and one of the questions which came up from internal staff was, you know, how do you handle sharpening in Capture One for Fuji cameras? And I said, well, exactly the same as any other camera. Like, I don't treat them any differently. There's no special tricks or you must use radius at this or don't turn this up or whatever. I just treat it as if it was a Canon, Nikon, Sony, whatever. I apply the same rules that I do for any other camera, which is how it should be. Because if you have a bunch of cameras, like I'm sure you do, Derek, mm-hmm. that you shouldn't have to really adopt the way you do things when you switch between camera models. Capture One should behave the same regardless of what camera you're using.
And then, you know, the other thing in Capture One Pro that I just love is the contrast slider. Mm. So before I start getting crazy with, you know, going clarity or any sort of creative sharpening, I do a little bit on the contrast slider. And Capture One decoding is already a bit contrasty in a good way.
Yeah.
So you don't have to do a whole lot there. But I'll tell you, if your lens profile is in there and you do a little contrast, then you don't need to do too much otherwise. And then output sharpening at the end for, you know, if you're sampling down or whatever. I mean, it's beautiful. The images are absolutely beautiful if you just take care of paying attention to how the software works.
Absolutely. And the contrast slider, that's a really good example, actually, because there's often a stigma attached that, you know, don't touch sliders. Or specifically the contrast slider, you should never use a contrast slider. It'll ruin the image. You should know how to do clever things with curves and so on. But our contrast slider is actually a really nice kind of compromise between full RGB curve, which tends to bump up saturation and skew the color a bit, compared to a luminosity curve, which just does pure contrast only and no color shift. The contrast slider is a really nice compromise between the two and just looks great. So I'm glad you've discovered that.
I think it's a magic algorithm myself. It is not contrast like you see anywhere else, that's for sure. I got to keep moving here though, because we got so many good things. Tell me about plugin support and what we might expect in the future with that, now that it's been opened up.
Yeah, sure. The plugin support, it's kind of one of those features that takes tons of R&D man hours but doesn't look so sexy on the surface because, you know, there's not a huge amount available right now. But the point of this feature is that before the interface of Capture One was closed off, if you like, or at least you couldn't go out from Capture One to anywhere else, there was always a middle step. So if you wanted to upload to your, you know, portfolio hosting site, whatever that might be, you first have to export to a place on your system, and then you have to upload and so on. So the whole point of the plugin architecture is to cut out that middle step and optimize the process from going to Capture One to another area, if you like, or some other service. So right now, what we've got available is format.com. It's a website creation service. And then we've got Helicon Focus, which just allows you to send to Stack for focus stacking. And then the third one, which is just coming online, is a JPEG Mini, which I'm sure you know very well.
Yeah.
So you can compress, do their super clever JPEG compression on site. But basically, there's a free SDK. So if Derek or anyone else wants to develop a plugin for Capture One, you can apply and just download the SDK and get cracking. We're open to anything.
I hope some good partnerships form around this.
Yeah, and if anyone listening and yourself, you think there's a good candidate, just shoot them a message and say, you know, please develop. I think the more voices that are heard, the more chance it's going to happen. So,
nice.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Tell me a little bit about this intelligent adjustments copying, because you've already had pretty good copy and paste adjustments where you can customize it with a clipboard and all that good stuff.
Yes.
But now we're going to a new level, right?
Well, it's kind of a minor thing, but a big irritation if you weren't used to how Capture One was doing things. So let's take a wedding photographer, for example. Quite often you have, you know, a sequence of shots which could be of the same thing. Let's say bride and groom walking down the aisle. And you're going to adjust those in much the same way, but composition is going to be different. So rotation might be different, cropping might be different, and so on. So in Capture One, what used to happen is, let's say you had a sequence of 20 shots or whatever, you copied your adjustments for the first shot. When you copied them over, it would always include everything, including compositional elements like rotation and crop. So you'd either have to then undo all of that on, you know, the images that you'd copied across to, or you would have to, after copying your images, go into the adjustment clipboard, uncheck the compositional elements you didn't want, like crop, for example, and then apply. And that's just one step too many for a busy wedding photographer who's got, you know, 3,000 shots they need to crack on through. So what happens now is that when you copy images, by default, we ignore what you've done compositional wise. So when you copy across, it does everything except composition. You can override that if you wish. So if you're used to the old way of behaving, then you can override that as well. But it just makes for a much simpler workflow. And it's a small thing, but it was actually a deal breaker for quite a few people when they were comparing it to what they were used to doing as well.
Yes, it's one of those small things that's a very big thing, actually.
Definitely.
I run into that all the time, and I use the second method that you talked about, where I copy everything, then I go to the adjustments clipboard, I undo composition, and then I move forward. And you're right, it's just sort of like a step that you don't want to do. It doesn't take forever, and sometimes you forget to do it, and you know,
exactly.
all that kind of stuff. And it becomes an annoyance. It really does.
It's just super frustrating.
Yeah. So this is really nice. And like you said, you can override it if you do want that composition to go with it, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Good.
So the default behavior is the new one, if you like, ignore composition. But in the adjustments clipboard, you can just disable that in the submenu. So it's easily reverted to the old faithful, if you like.
Yeah, that's a really nice touch, David. I'm really happy about that.
Yeah, it's a small thing sometimes. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk. We got to talk a little bit about luminosity masking.
Yes.
And I guess we should start out by kind of saying why you'd want to use it, which is, my understanding always has been, if you just want to make an adjustment to a specific tonal range in a shot, then you can use luminosity masking to do that. Is that kind of your understanding as well?
Yeah, exactly. It's creating a mask which would be very difficult to draw by hand, or time-consuming, or just boring, if you like, creating it, you know, instantly by very easily selecting the tonal range. So that could either be a very narrow range, or it could be a very broad range. So, but however you do it, it just creates a complex mask in a couple of clicks. So that's the benefit.
Particularly good for shadow areas, I think, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're only scratching the surface with the sort of techniques that people are going to use for it. So, yeah, selecting shadow areas for targeted noise reduction could be something, or just selecting the deepest blacks and darkening them even more, and it gives a really nice sort of different contrast look. It's normally easy to target skin tones as well, because they tend to fall in that sort of mid-tone range. Mm-hmm. So all kinds of uses, really. But it kind of gets even more exciting when you start combining sort of gradient masks also with a luminosity mask, because a luminosity mask isn't something that's unique in terms of the way it's created in Capture One. I can apply a luminosity range to any other kind of mask. So whether I've brushed it on by hand, whether I've filled the whole layer with a mask, or as I said, with a gradient mask. So if I want to just put a gradient on a sky but not affect something in front of that, it's actually really easy to do, which you couldn't do before.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we wanted, isn't it? When you have those trees and stuff sticking up into that sky, that we want to ignore on the gradient mask. So is there anything special about the implementation of luminosity masking in version 12 that you think, did they give any phase one secret sauce here?
Well, I think the sort of basic premise is quite rudimentary or simple. So you're saying select values from whatever 0 to 50, and that's where we're going to mask, which is fine. But the clever stuff is what happens outside of those ranges. So what the fall off is like, and how the mask follows edges or ignores edges. So like in our tree example, the mask that you would put on the sky behind the tree, you would actually want it to hug that tree pretty tightly so you didn't get any halos, or, you know, when you push clarity sort of way too much, you can see halos around objects sitting in the sky. I mean, that would make the mask look really obvious. So you'd want it to wrap really nice and tight around every leaf twig structure, and no one would know you've done something clever. Whereas on a mask, which say you did for skin, you might want it to be feathered a bit, so softer, so it just bleeds nicely into the sort of various different tones and things. And I think that's the clever part. So as well as having the range selection, you have the choice of using two other sliders. The way they're set up by default, they sort of don't do anything. It will just give you a pretty nice mask, which works in a lot of situations. But if you start to play with those sliders, then you can go from a really feathered mask to a sort of super refined mask, if you like. So it gives you lots and lots of choice.
That's terrific. That's really good. And, you know, we mentioned, gradient mask when you're talking about luminosity masking. But so now we also have radial gradient masks in this version.
Yes. Which was something you could argue we should have done a long time ago, because it's a very popular feature and it's been missing from Capture One. So it's, you know, I'm very happy and relieved to say that we have it. There's always been the ability to do a vignette, if you like, in Capture One. But of course, it was only fairly basic. It was a circular shape or a elliptical shape, and it just followed the crop. So if you wanted to do something a little bit more creative, then you had to go ahead and do it with a brush, like a layer. You had to draw your own radial mask, if you like, which is fine, but it's still considerably more time consuming than just drawing a quick ellipse on the screen, adjusting the fall off, and away you go. It's just much more comfortable and faster to do it this way.
Yeah, I definitely fell into the camp where I either wanted the vignette tool improved, or I wanted radial gradient mask. We needed one or the other.
Exactly.
Know, because the vignette tool is very basic, as you know, and I don't think it has changed in this version. And I guess
no, it's the same. Yeah.
No need to as much now that we have radial.
No. Yeah. I think I'll still use the vignette when I have a pretty symmetrical image that I just want to dip the corners a bit, but I think for a lot of subjects, that additional flexibility is great. And again, what I really like about, the way it's implemented, if I draw my radial mask on a layer and then I want to adjust it, then I just hover the cursor back over and I can change the shape without having to redraw it all over again, which is really nice.
So before I let you get on to your evening, because you are working late for us tonight. I appreciate that, by the way.
That's all right. this is fun work, you know.
Exactly. So when you first started working with this version of the application, just personally, what things have you really enjoyed? You know, what are your favorite features? We've kind of gone through the whole laundry list now, but, you know, what did you go, gosh, I'm really glad we have that now?
For me, it's got to be luminosity masking, just because it's so flexible, and I keep discovering sort of new ways to use it and work with it. And I think I'm only 20% into it, and it's super, super exciting. And it's one of those features where you're like, oh yeah, luminosity masking, that would be great. I probably won't use it much. But when you combine it with, you know, radial masks and the linear masks as well, it's really kind of cool, the stuff that you can do. And it's not like you're ruining the image or kind of chopping it up into something horrific. There's just really nice subtle ways that you can use it. So I've really enjoyed playing around with that, definitely.
So I really appreciate you hanging out with us. I mean, this has been great.
Pleasure.
So David, you guys do have a 30-day free trial, right?
Yes, we do. So, and it's fully functional. So it's not like we cut any nice bits out or anything. So you can just head to phase1.com or captureone.com, whatever you find easier to remember, and to the download section. And then you can download Capture One. You will see a few different versions. So we have Capture One Pro, and there's also Pro Fujifilm. So that's only supporting Fuji cameras, as we spoke about earlier, and also Pro Sony. And there is also the free version for Fujifilm and Sony as well, which is has much less features, but it's great. If you just want to go that bit further than out-of-camera JPEG and just do some nice, simple edits to your RAW files, but nothing too heavy or taxing if you're new to RAW conversion, then that's a really good way to get started.
Yeah, you still get that excellent raw decoding, and you know that's
absolutely
what you get with Capture One Pro. Thank you so much, David. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Pleasure being here as well. Thanks, Derek.
Alrighty.
Thank you so much, David. That was a terrific interview, and I really enjoyed having you on the show. And I really enjoy Capture One Pro 12. So it's a win-win all the way around. 10 qualities of a successful online portfolio. Even if you very actively promote your work on social media, your online portfolio is still the mothership, the primary showcase of your talents into which all other promotional streams will flow. But putting together a successful portfolio website can seem like a daunting task. Where to begin? Actually, it's pretty simple, and the best portfolio sites all tend to have the same qualities. Follow our 10-point guide to creating an effective online portfolio, and you will soon be up and running. And that's what this piece is about. So I have a link in here that takes you over to Portfolio Box's site, the article 10 Qualities of a Successful Online Portfolio, and you should really look at it, because they have done a terrific job of pulling together the things that you should be thinking about when you build your portfolio. Now, to create your own Portfolio Box site, all you have to do is click on the tile that runs on every page of the digital story or the link that's in the show notes to get started. And the reason why you want to do that is because you can start out with a free site. You can implement some of these things that you learn in the article, the 10 qualities of a successful online portfolio. But if you decide to upgrade to the pro site, which I have a feeling you'll probably want to do once you get going with this, then you'll save 20% off the $83 annual price. And that includes getting your own custom domain name. So Portfolio Box, they have inspiration for us that we've been talking about over the last few weeks, but they also have lots of techniques to really help you construct the portfolio that knocks people's socks off. And that's what we want to do. They have the tools to do it, but they also have the knowledge to do it. So I would start by going over to the article, take a look at, you know, the design ideas and the concepts that you want to embrace. Then click on the tile in the digital story, set up your site, get going. And a big thanks to Portfolio Box for sponsoring this show. I've booked our accommodations for the Joshua Tree Workshop this coming March. I'm so excited about this that even with my terrible voice, I'm going to talk about it. So I have this place, and it took me a long time to find exactly the right place, very close to the entrance of Joshua Tree, where we're going to be setting up our field camp. So we have a field camp reserved inside Joshua Tree National Park. And then we have, you know, basically a headquarters where our sleeping accommodations, where the kitchen, where the showers, where our workroom, where we're going to do our lab, all that stuff is going to be. And that's only a few miles away. And the name of the place that we have is called the Adobe Rock Pile. And just let me read you the description for this place that we have for the workshop. The Adobe Rock Pile is located conveniently on the way to Joshua Tree National Park, just minutes from the west entrance. Enjoy our hammock, hot tub, views, and desert scenery. This property is a perfect blend of comfort, convenience, nature, and high desert style. The Adobe Rock Pile is located in the most beautiful neighborhood in the hills of Yucca Valley. It feels like you're in a national park, but you're only 2 miles away from all the in-town amenities. You're surrounded by open space, boulders, and other custom homes with plenty of space in between, and lots of space in between. You will feel all the comforts of home and more in this neighborhood. And this is what's so cool about this place. So for instance, when we want to do our night shooting, we don't have to pack up and go all the way back into the park, because where we're staying is like in a national park. You know, it's called the Rock Pile because you have all the cool boulders like you have in Joshua Tree. You have the yucca trees. You have all that good stuff. But it's right there in our backyard. We have a really spacious work area inside, so we can work at a big long table during our lab, or we can hang out and work in the various, you know, areas on the sofas, outside on the deck. There's a hot tub out there, which is quite nice. The surrounding area, even if you just went and hung out there and just, you know, took little walks in the morning and did all that kind of stuff, you would have a great trip, let alone all the activities and photography that we have planned. So I'm super excited about this. We're all going to stay together in the Rock Pile. And we have bedrooms. We have beds. We have beds for everyone. And it's just going to be one of those very special experiences. Now, if you want to join us this coming March, all you have to do is go over to the workshop's sign-up page. I have the link in the show notes. Or you can go to thenimblephotographer.com and just click on the workshop link there. And it'll take you over to the page that has all four workshops. Click on the Joshua Tree one. Put down your $100 deposit. That will reserve your space. And then pretty soon, we're going to be having reservation forms go out. And then that way, you're guaranteed a spot in this workshop. This is one that if you want to do high desert scenery, if you want to do night photography, if you want to hang out with your fellow photographers, and if you want to just relax and get away from the world, this is going to be the workshop for you. Coming up this March 2019, I really hope you can join me. All right, just a couple updates here. Inner Circle members, we're still going on with our photo challenge. We have another few days to go. Night shot. I'm getting lots of great shots. I'm going through every one of them. I'm sharing some of them with you. It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to pick, you know, the honoree for the night shot, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. We have the site for us to share our work and to, you know, have a, you know, a special area for us. And I really appreciate your support for the podcast. If you want to become an Inner Circle member, just click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the digital story. And finally, a big thanks to our friends at Red River Paper. They are the inkjet kings. They have the paper, they have the ink, they have all the supplies that go with it. They have the training, they have the reviews. We have a tile for Red River Paper on all the pages of the digital story. Click on it, go over to our landing page, take a look around. See what excites you, make some art, and then share it with people this holiday season. Red River Paper also has a great Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. And a big thanks to them for sponsoring this show. All right, that's going to do it for me. Next week, my voice will be back, and I'll be very happy about that, as I'm sure you will too. Come back and join me. There's going to be lots to talk about. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye now.